Call the meeting to order, please. Representative Thiessen has reviewed the minutes of our February 10th meeting and moved their approval. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Our agenda today is sort of related topics. First of all, Representative Cox has two bills dealing with intermediate care facilities. And then I'll have a bill on long-term care provider rate increases. So I thought it might be best to do Representative Cox's bills first. I think we can move through those fairly quickly this morning. So Representative Cox, if you'd like to come to the table as you're coming, I'll move that House File 490 be held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Health and Human Services Finance Bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a author's amendment on this bill, if you would be open to that.
Members, Representative Cox did talk to me about this, and I would put it in the classification of a clarification of author's original intent. So why don't you explain what the amendment is? I think it had it as a verbal amendment, and then I'll make that motion for it. So please explain.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, on page 3, under section 2, on line 13, I'd like to strike the word some, and on line 14, strike the word of. So it will read, recommended to support the people now receiving services. And then a little farther down on line 16, I'd like to insert, after adequate, I'd like to insert state and federal. So that will read adequate state and federal financial resources. And that's it.
Okay, I'll move then, members. If there's no objections, this did not meet the 24-hour rule, but I think it is a pretty simple clarification of author's intent. There no objection to the offering the amendment? Seeing none, I'll move. I'm sorry.
I did not. I'll
repeat it. I'll repeat it. Members, I'll move then that House File 375 be amended on page 3, line 13, to strike the word some, on line 14, to strike the word of, and on line 16, after the word adequate, insert the words state and federal. Do I have that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you. Do I understand that amendment? Ready to vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Cox, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to
Number three,
the bill.
I'm sorry. I think I said 375. I was looking at the wrong one. That motion should have been House File 490.
490. That's correct.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 490 deals with the cost shift repeal for the intermediate care facilities for the mentally retarded in the state. And it also includes a plan to prepare a plan for people that are being served by these same facilities. Many of you may remember the 2003 legislature changed the way payments are made to intermediate care facilities. Payments had been 100% state and 0% county, and the 203 change shifted this to a 90-10 state and county on the overall state costs. This change in the funding has placed some burdens on counties, and it has created some problems for some of the intermediate care facilities that are operating in the state. I'm seeing some with increased bed vacancies and so forth. And I believe the intermediate care facilities provide a much-needed option for care for mentally disabled folks here that are in Minnesota, and they do that at reasonable rates to the taxpayers. So I would like to have you consider this bill for inclusion in your final bill. And I think an important component of this bill is the plan language that is in there, asking the commissioner to work with providers and consumers and to get together and discuss intermediate care facility options, what directions the state, you know, maybe should go, how to finance them, just really look at a whole number of issues that are laid out in the bill. There are a number of other, that's all I really have to say. I'll stand for some questions, but there are some other folks who are here with me today that would like to address the bill.
I'm sorry,
Well, I was just saying that's all I really need to say on the bill right now, Mr. Chairman, but there are some other folks in the audience that would like to address it. I'd answer any questions that you may have.
Certainly. Before we begin, I do have one. Looking at the fiscal note, and I think members have it in your packet, the yellow sheets. It shows, I mean, I assume that's because of the start date of this, so the more operative is about $10 million in the 06 year. I was sort of given to believe that most counties were not moving people to ICFMRs of this larger size because of that 20%, and yet this would sort of indicate a savings. And I don't know if you've had any feedback on this, Representative Cox, but I mean, $10 million is a fair amount. What's your impression in terms of what the county action has actually been as compared to what the law says?
Well, I think some others may address that better than myself, but my reaction in the homes that I have in my district that I probably have most contact with are we are seeing vacancies, which causes issues at those homes. The savings that may show up here that were booked, and I believe, Mr. Chairman, when this was done in 2003, the savings were projected to be somewhere over $11 million in the savings at that time, so the numbers probably aren't far different. But I think we don't have the information on what the corresponding waivered services may be, some of the, if there's any day services and so forth, on offsetting on this. The reductions in the ICFMRs, I don't think the state is probably far off on this. I think this is probably an accurate fiscal note from what I can gather, but
I'm sorry to divert because I should allow the testifier, but Mr. Nelson, if you have some comment to that specific question, I'd appreciate it. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bruce Nelson from ARM. We're an association that represents and includes about 150 providers who employ about 25,000 support professionals in the disability area, including most of the ICFMR. I was trying to catch the full question. I think I have some the sheet I'm handing out, Mr. Chair, some data that might shed some light on what I was picking up as the question. Could you rephrase it?
Certainly, Mr. Nelson. My question, and sort of preface it with, anecdotally at least, I've heard counties sort of unwilling to place people in larger ICFMRs because of that 20% penalty. And the fiscal note that we have shows about a $10 million savings, and that sort of doesn't necessarily jive. So what I'm wondering, at least anecdotally, what are you seeing in terms of the experience of counties actually placing people and then living with that 20%?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, anecdotally, and we do have some information on the sheet that I can get to later, counties are increasingly, and understandably, reluctant to place people in ICFMR, and therefore there are an increasing number of open beds that are occurring. There is some synergy, as Representative Cox mentioned, with the waivered services, and tension is there. Many counties are near their caps on the waiver side, and so it depends upon the county sometimes whether you want to fill that ICFMR bed and take the financial hit there, or jeopardize hitting your cap on the waiver side. But we are finding with ICFMR with more than six beds, those are the ICFs affected here, an increasing number of open beds and difficulty getting referrals across the state.
Okay, well, I think that's sufficient for the moment. Why don't you go ahead and proceed then with your testimony?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. When this legislation passed in 2003 to go into effect last July, we feared that there would be an acceleration of downsizing and closure of ICFMR across the state. There is a natural attrition that some people are choosing. People now living in ICFMR are choosing at a rate of between 200 and 300 a year to move into waivered services or other services. But we feared that there'd be an unnatural acceleration of that kind of closure, not driven by choice of the consumer and not driven by the marketplace. On the chart that we've prepared, there are really two bodies of information here. Up on the top of the line is a survey that we conducted between July 1, 2003 and September 20th of 2004 of of ICFSMR, and you can see how many are, and we were looking not only for closure, but status change, and that would include, have you closed? Are you considering closing? How about downsizing so you get under that magic number of six, or considering that, or relocating, and that would be, say you have an ICFMR with 12 people, and relocating it so you have three ICFMR at six beds, you know, so that you, so the counties wouldn't have to do to pay that. So that's the status change. Then we look at our members, and ARM represents most of the ICFMR providers in Minnesota, and we found that in talking to all of our members who are ICFMR providers, 32 of them, or 57%, reported a status change as a result of, a direct result of the county cost shift. And when you look at how change was due to cost shift, you notice that that in 18 counties, 22 were initiated by the county. This gets to your earlier point, Mr. Chair, organizations receiving inadequate referrals. We got word on two, but I can say anecdotally that as we talk to more and more people, that's a higher number. And we'll get to this more in a moment, but the interesting dynamic is a lot of counties, we've been talking to providers, are kind of waiting to see what's going to happen here in this legislative session. We're kind of, you know, in a standstill. Will this be repealed? If it is, life goes on. If it's not, counties are indicating increasingly to our members, you can see, you know, the number six here, for sure, waiting to see what happens if this is repealed. Some of the looming pressures, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, on the bullets below, open beds, we've already spoken to that. Number two, we did an analysis a year ago, and we've had a lot of discussion with the department on whose numbers are right and statistical methodology. I think it's fair to say, and we can get into this at some other date if you wish, but when you look at absolute closures and the last day of somebody being served in an ICFMR, and we looked at real closures, and then the first day, usually in a waivered services, we found that there was a pretty significant increase in overall cost in moving those folks over to waivered services. A good example of why that happens is, say you have a 16-bed ICFMR, and you're serving people with very high medical needs, requiring an overnight nurse. You have one overnight nurse in a 16-bed ICFMR. Then if you move down into the waiver, typically with serving four people, that one nurse turns into four. That's just one of the cost drivers that where you lose some of the economies of scale as we unnaturally force the closure and downsizing of ICFMR. Number three, the third bullet down, I mentioned earlier that some counties are really doing serious math and trying to figure out, should we pay this darn thing or force the closure of, if we can, of ICFMR that are more than six beds, or should we bite the bullet on that because of the increasing pressure over on the waiver side with the growing costs and the way the department and the state now looks at the waiver. You have a certain amount of money, and if you overspend that in your allocation, then the county is liable. So they're looking at where their cap is on the waiver side. So that kind of dynamic is going on back and forth as well. Finally, down at the last bullet, we talk about pending changes. I always like to talk about real people more than facilities necessarily, and the pending changes that were reported to us are 969 beds in the ICFMR system represented by our members, or 43%. I think the upshot is that we are beginning to decertify, and I think it will happen at a much accelerated pace if this is not repealed, decertifying, closing, relocating, downsizing ICFMR for the wrong reasons. It's not driven by what consumers and their families want. It's not driven by the marketplace. There is sort of a natural attrition going on, and this really accelerates that attrition in a very unnatural way, and essentially is resulting in, and will increasingly result in the essentially the eviction of people in from their homes where they've lived for sometimes 20 or 30 years. Representative Cox mentioned the plan that we call for. I think this begs the question. What's been happening to the ICFMR system in the last few years with you know, little a knife here and a little knife there, and losing various elements of the funding system around variable rates that respond to people's changing needs, and downsizing money that used to be there. It's not there now if you do downsize. It really does beg the question, do we want in Minnesota an ICFMR system for people to choose if they want it? And so the plan language asks that question. And if we do, who are the people? Should we define a population? Certainly we want to honor choice, and we will. The state has a commitment to honoring consumer choice. But maybe there are specific populations driven by high medical need, driven by high behavior issues, or other things, where we really do want an ICFMR system. And if we do, what's the capacity of that system? And once we can define that in the study, let's assure that we do have the adequate resources to meet the needs of those people. And that plan then would come back to you, this committee, next year.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Cox, you had a list of others. Mike Klott, is that
next? Yes, Mike Klott is here with the Lutheran Home Association of Belle Plaine. And if Mike could come up, he can address some of these issues as well.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Michael Klott, and I serve as president of the Lutheran Home Association based in Belle Plaine, where we own and operate a 52-bed ICFMR. Named the Hope Residents. Our organization has served persons with disabilities and the elderly since 1898 on this campus. The Hope Residents is a unique ICFMR. It is often a home for individuals throughout Minnesota because they fall through the cracks and system changes. Challenging diagnoses coupled with high medical complexities are common ailments of those we serve. Individuals, families, county case managers, and other providers have seen this program fulfill a very special need. Our ICFMR, along with well over 100 other programs, is severely threatened by the county cost shift legislation. What we have found is that counties do not have the resources to help with the shift. The passing of this original legislation has been confirmed to be about money, not philosophy of size. The intent of the legislation was not to arbitrarily close ICFMRs without any thought or pretext. Yet as this cost shift has now taken force, we have not been able to fill beds. We do have, however, referrals. We also have two examples of counties that, because of this shift, are not placing residents in our residents anymore. That is why we developed and supported this legislation and also legislation unique to our program to repeal this cost shift. We strongly urge your support for these bills, HF 490 and 375. We cannot underscore enough the threat to persons with developmental disabilities, their families, and our organization that this county cost shift has caused. Families and individuals with developmental disabilities want real choice in housing and services, real choices in medical care, and community involvement. Our team members, direct caregivers who are in this audience today, devote their love and passion daily to make a profound difference to those we serve. We come to you, as Mr. Nelson mentioned, to seek a critical emergency remedy to address this. Time is fleeting, and I think a lot of organizations are waiting to see what happens this session to resolve this. And we hope that we can get this resolved this year. We ask you to act on both our residents today and their family members who are not able to be here to voice their own opinions. We thank you for the opportunity to be present today and to testify before you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony. Mm-hmm. Senator Cox, do you have additional testimonies?
There are a few others that are here. John Husted. John, with the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance, has a a few words to share with us, too.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Husted. I'm Vice President of Public Affairs at the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance. I know that you have a long agenda, so I won't take up a lot of time except to say that we definitely support this bill, and Mike Klatt from the Lutheran Home Association, one of our members, expressed, I think, our viewpoints pretty well. So I'll just go on record as saying we strongly support it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And then, Mr. Chair, I believe Judith Broomfield from Scott County is here, and can give a little bit of a comment.
Ms. Wilkinson's coming forward, too, if you want to.
Yep.
Direct
mm-hmm.
the chair that we can just
yep.
get you at the table and
let you both be up here.
Hi.
Okay. All right.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be short and sweet, hopefully, here, because some of the information has been given. But my name is Shirley Hokanson. I am testifying on behalf of RIM Minnesota today. First of all, thanks to Representative Cox for offering House File 490, which, as has been indicated, would repeal the 20% share of the non-federal medical assistance costs for ICFMRs, specifically those ICFMR residents with seven or more individuals and who have resided there for 90 days. RIM strongly supports this bill for several reasons. Since 2003, when the cost shift was enacted, there has been considerable activity relating to the use of these community residents. As the ARM numbers show, close to one-third of the ICFMR have experienced a change. A significant number of these were due to the shift. In mid-2003, RIM had 613 ICFMR beds. By mid-2004, 89 beds had been closed or downsized, and now the number is down to 502 beds in 48 programs. Of these, 27 are over 7 beds. Noting this trend, we are deeply concerned that some counties are now reluctant to fill vacancies. This action by the counties is understandable, considering the financial burden that counties are now asked to bear. However, what has happened, and more than likely will continue to happen if this cost shift is not repealed, is that a viable community residential option will have been removed as a choice for many, including consumers and families. Many of the changes that have taken place have resulted in disruption in the lives of those who have had to make the change. RIM has consistently supported community services in smaller settings, yet we believe that one size does not necessarily fit all. Furthermore, it does not appear that there has been a consistent policy on the use of or future of ICFMR community residents. In fact, it is not unreasonable to suggest that this policy was sort of backed into closing or downsizing by way of the funding rather than effectively and inclusively having planned for a change. As you will note, and as Bruce has mentioned, Section 2 of the bill provides for a complete review and assessment, quotes, concerning the future of services provided to people now served in ICFMRs. This action is long overdue. Finally, as ARM's numbers also show, there are higher costs associated with people moving from these community residents to the waiver. Even though in many cases such a move might be indicated, it does not appear that it is a money saver. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony.
Brumfield?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judith Brumfield from the Scott County Social Services has something to say.
Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for this opportunity to be here today and to speak in support of House File 490. For the record, my name is Judith Brumfield, and I am the Social Services Director in Scott County. I am here today representing three county associations, AMC, the Association of Minnesota Counties, MICA, and MAXA, the Association of County Social Service Administrators. I'm also representing Scott County, and I want to communicate on their behalf the strong support among county elected and appointed officials for the passage of House File 490. First of all, I want to thank Representative Cox and the co-authors for their dedicated support on this key issue. Section 1 of the bill, which repeals the county cost share for ICFMR facilities, is a top legislative priority for counties in the human services area this year. We're grateful that the House included this provision in their Omnibus Health and Human Services finance bill last year, and we're hopeful that it receives such positive consideration this year. There are a number of reasons that counties support this proposal that relate to both fiscal and best practice considerations. From a fiscal standpoint, in the early 1990s, counties collectively reached an agreement with the state to create county general aid, homestead agricultural credit aid, HACA, dollars in exchange for state funding of income maintenance programs, including the Minnesota Medicaid program, medical assistance. But beginning in 2002, the legislature began reversing this agreement by establishing county cost shares for certain types of institutional care funded by medical assistance. There's no question that the state has fallen on challenging fiscal times, but I'm sure that you would agree that shifting costs to county taxpayers is not a viable long-term solution to the state's problems. For example, Scott County Board was forced to increase their levy by $350,000 for the 2005 budget in response to this particular cost shift. That will be an ongoing cost to the county unless this particular portion is repealed. It's challenging and frustrating for each of us on the county level to explain to the county taxpayers why they must assume an additional cost and a cost that is unrelated to their property in any way and for which they, as county residents, receive no additional service or benefit. Beyond fiscal considerations, a blanket incentive for community care is not consistent with best practices, including legal and safety considerations. County cost shares were initially conceived in part as an incentive to counties to move individuals from institutional care to the community settings. That was not necessarily the intent of this particular piece of legislation on the ICFMR facilities. In reality, though, the effect of such a policy shift is to create the potential for inequities in service availability across the state. Counties agree with the policy and practice of placement in the least restrictive alternative and are committed to accomplishing this goal. However, the fiscal disparities that exist between different counties often mean that counties with the highest number of persons in poverty, thus the high level of eligibility for medical assistance, have the lowest property tax base. Therefore, counties with the highest need often have the least ability to meet that need. Rather than enhancing the quality of care, county cost shares have a potential to increase inequities of care based on the county residents across the state, which is in direct conflict with MA's status as a statewide entitlement program. Legal precedent also dictates that consumers with disabilities receive treatment in the least restrictive environment. However, consumers with several functional and or cognitive limitations that would make individuals unable to function in a community setting sometimes require too high a level of care to be maintained safely and cost-effectively in the community. In addition, from a legal standpoint, under the Olmstead decision, individuals can choose to live in a more restrictive setting and cannot be forced to move if they do not wish to. Counties should not be held financially responsible to move these groups of individuals into community settings, but under the ICFMR cost share, there is no distinction made among different types of residents. In summary, the county cost share of ICFMR creates a financial incentive in direct conflict with the best practice, including safety and legal considerations. Unless this particular portion of the law is repealed, there's a potential to increase service inequities based on county of residence, increase property taxes or reduce other necessary services, and cause unnecessary and disruptive moves for some of our most vulnerable citizens. In Scott County alone, we face a number of challenges since this county cost share went into effect last July 1st. And as a rapidly growing county, we have growing service needs, and we're faced with either raising property tax levies or cutting other necessary services to our residents. Mr. Chair and members, I want to thank you once again for the opportunity to speak and support a cause file 490. And if there are any questions, I'd be glad
thank
to
Thank you. Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's just for my information, if the counties have an incentive not to move these folks into the ICFMR or actually to move them out, where ultimately, what are the remaining choices that they have?
Ms. Rumfield?
Mr. Chair, Representative, our choices are somewhat limited, and I think people also have addressed the caps on the ICFMR waiver. One of the options, though, is to look at possible waiver funding to create small facilities, potentially four-bed facilities. For many of the residents, this is a far more expensive alternative, and that will certainly impact the state's budget in the long term. The other alternative simply is not to place people who may be living with family members and allow them as family members age and have less ability to care for them in positions where they are more vulnerable than we would like for them to be. It severely limits the choice, both on the part of the county and, more importantly, on the part of our citizens.
Thank you. No further questions. Is there anyone else? Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify regarding this bill? Seeing no one, at least I can't resist. We did pass this in this committee last year in the supplemental bill, and I think it was already mentioned, so I think we have that as a base. I don't necessarily feel sorry for the counties in terms of the 20% if it were the right policy. I think the fundamental question is it the right policy? And I think increasingly, if you've been, as I've been, and I've visited several ICFMR facilities and families who have people there and found these are wonderful places and are the appropriate place for them to be served. I think the good part of the bill, in addition to sort of repealing this, because I think there is a serious question about whether it's the right policy, but the other part is to sort of really re-examine where are we. I mean, we were sort of on a march, and I think when we implemented this, we were sort of on the march to everything for is a magic number or 5 or 6 or whatever it is, small numbers, but increasingly I think we're bringing question to that. And in my own opinion, and I think it was opinion of the committee last year unanimously, this is a policy that, although well-intentioned, isn't really the right direction for us. And with the combination of the change in the penalty and the study, I think we've got a great bill here. Thank you, Representative Fox.
Thank you.
But if there's no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 490, as amended, be considered for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Finance Bill. Oops, that's a motion. That's not passed, is it? How about a vote? All those in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Cox. Now, to your other bill, House File 375, I will move similarly House File 375 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Health Bill. Representative Cox, this ought to be short and sweet, right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is similar. I'm not going to go through all the issues. It's basically identical issues that you just heard on the larger ICFMRs. This bill is a targeted bill that's addressing Scott County's issues and the specific cost shifts that we've all outlined on here. Don't need to go into all that again. One of the biggest impacts on this will be at the Hope Residence in Belle Plaine, operated by the Lutheran Home Association, a wonderful facility where some great hardworking people are caring for people that truly need these services, and I really think that it's to the benefit of everybody in the state of Minnesota to see that this home continues to be able to provide these services to these individuals. And as the previous testimony have indicated, it's at risk. So that's all I will have to say, but I would ask if Mike Pott from the Lutheran Home would have anything to add to this specific bill here.
And as he's coming forward, Representative Cox, if I see what this is recommending is to change the 20% to 10%, just so people understand what the recommendation is.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, last year we have been one of the leaders with Representative Cox and other providers on the complete repeal of the legislation. We support 490. That is our preferred bill, but we submitted this last year, and the committee passed it last year. But this is an imminent threat to this program. It is a program that is the only ICFMR that is directly connected to a nursing facility in the state of Minnesota, and some of the residents that we do serve there have some significant needs that may be somewhat different in other settings, and that's the reason why we put this bill in originally last year. But our preference, again, is for a complete repeal on 490.
And Mr. Chair, and members, I would add that if you've ever had a chance to see a facility like this, the way that it operates with the link between the nursing home and the care and the number of elderly residents that they have in there, I think you really will understand how important a facility is like this. And as you heard earlier, the Scott County is a growing county, and this is a really important component. I'm not sure where a lot of these people would be served if this closed.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Representative Rotunda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cox, does this give Scott County an advantage and surrounding counties a disadvantage in singling out that county?
Representative Cox.
Representative Rotunda, the counties are eligible to really send. In fact, I think Mr. Cox could address. I don't know how many different counties you have residents from right now, but all counties can send to this.
Representative Trumbo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What about other facilities that are in other counties that are not sending?
Representative Trumbo, there may be perceived some advantage in there. What I was focusing on was the entire Hope Residence and the Lutheran Home Association, which is rather unique in that it's a 52-bed ICFMR connected as part of a nursing facility. There's some real symbiotic relationships that can work on administrative and staff, and you may have instances where an individual may need to be shifted over to a nursing home for, you know, a week, 3 weeks, whatever, stabilized and brought back. Just all sorts of things, I think, that allow this to function very well. Not sure that everybody has that, all CFMRs. I know they don't. But it's enough of a unique situation that I think it should be supported.
I think Representative Trumbo is on a track that I think I understand, and I am not anxious to see a stampede of these kind of bills from every ICFMR in the state. I understand that you may consider you have a unique case. It would certainly be the hope of this chair that we do whatever we do across the board. Others are certainly free to do. I just hope it doesn't turn into that. I think that's sort of what you were hinting at, is are there others that are going to say I have a similar case, and they may very well. They may very well. But I hope that we can do whatever we do across the board.
I would hope so, too, and the earlier bill would do that.
Right. Any further discussion? If there are none, renew my motion that House File 375 be considered for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Understand that motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Cox.
Thank you.
I'm going to turn the gavel over to Representative Huntley. It would be sort of fun to have the vice chair speak to the committee, because he has a wonderful squeaky little voice today, but we won't do that to him. I'll move to the table.
Representative Bradley, make your motion?
Yes.
On House File 775.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 775 for a possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And Mr. Chair, has the amendment been passed out yet? We're doing it right now. All right, as that's being passed out, member, there is an oversight in the bill. And again, I'll ask the recommendation from the committee, because this would not meet the timeline. All it does is affirm what was the intention of the author from the beginning. What was intended in the bill is a 3% in each of the 2 years of the next biennium increase in rates for a wide spectrum of service organizations. What I forgot was that the nursing home one is put on top of the contract nursing homes. That was not my intent. If you remember, I think when the governor reviewed his proposal for the 2% nursing homes, they first took away the automatic inflator for the contract nursing homes. Well, I should have done the same thing. So what this would do, Amendment A1, would make that very same change. And all that does is sort of delay the rate years in beyond the next biennium, so that we would not be sort of piling the 3% on top of the current statutory language increase for the contract nursing homes. So it would make it even for all nursing homes then, as well as the other groups. So if there's no objection of members in offering the amendment, I would like to offer Amendment A1.
Representative Bradley offers the Amendment A1. Any discussion on that? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I won't pretend that that I have a corner, because I think that the sentiment on doing what House File 775 proposes to do is something that we all support on a bipartisan level. However, I have the good fortune of being the chief author of the bill, and I represent as such. The bill, in a very straightforward way, would offer a cost of living adjustment. You hear this term COLA, and that's basically what this bill is. It would offer a 3% in the first year and 3% in the second year increase, given, of course, there's a slight correction, and that correction would have an effect on the fiscal note, and I'll speak a little bit to the fiscal note later. Mm-hmm. Let me give for you the list, because it's sometimes hard to read. I think it's easy enough to see in the bill that this applies to nursing facilities. That's pretty straightforward. It also is easy enough to see that this applies to ICSMR, because that's clear language in the bill. The remainder of the service groups are a little bit more obscure, because it's kind of by statutory reference, and I'll just give you sort of a list of them. It does include home and community-based waiver programs. That's sort of what we think about as group homes, is kind of probably the most common. It does include private personal care and nursing supervision of personal care services, so the PCA services, which can be in-home or it can be actually even in group homes. It includes private duty nursing services. It includes day training and rehabilitation services. It includes occupational therapy, speech and language therapy, and respiratory therapy services. It includes alternative care services for the elderly. It includes adult residential program grants. It includes semi-independent living services, and also includes community support services for deaf and hard of hearing adults with mental illness. Over the years, and I think, 8-10 years ago or so, we struggled with trying to identify, when we have this language for a COLA, to make sure that we are covering all of the spectrum of people who serve the most vulnerable people in our society. And I think this has been pretty standard language that we've had in those groups. That's the nature of the groups. I think there are a good many people who would like to testify. I'd ask that the testifiers try to be brief. I know that we have many that would do it. I think the fundamental message that I hear, of course, and I'll give you just a little bit of background, members. 2 years ago, there was a recommendation for the same spectrum of providers to have a 4% reduction in their rates. The House's very strong position was that we wanted no reduction in any of those rates, and it was a tough battle for us. It was very, very tough for us in 2 years ago in the budget to find the alternative money to support it. We won, at least for nursing homes, to have no cut in their rates. We couldn't quite make the final 1% for group homes and the other provider groups, so there was a 1% reduction in their rates in 2003. So that means that for the current biennium, nursing homes have had flat funding, and the other groups have had an actual 1% rate reduction for themselves. I think we all know that those organizations, and by the way, let me say there was considerable pressure in the conference committee to make that 4% reduction. I think I have a few scars on the and a few all-nighters and a few times when I had outbursts and went sulking back to the state office building over this, because I really believed in my heart that there would have been a way to at least make it even. But I think in the end, we did a darn good job as a House in trying to minimize the impact. Now we're in another year. The expenses for those places have continued to increase. A lot of you have probably heard from nursing homes about their liability insurance increases. In my own personal level, having just visited my brother in a group home up in Glenwood, the staff there looks at me and says, "Representative Bradley, when are you going to give me an increase?" On an even more personal level, my daughter-in-law is a personal care attendant. Every time we start session, Robin says to me, "Dad, when am I going to get an increase?" These are people that do wonderful work, and thank God, frankly, for their big hearts, because even if we give the increase, this is not going to make millionaires out of people who work hard and receive relatively low pay. These are people who get a lot of fulfillment out of the kind of things that they do every day with a loving care, and I'm just so happy to try to do something for them. So, with that, Mr. Chair, I think let's call forth the list of these that I have, the Patty Cullen, first of all, and maybe Patty Cullen and Mr. Husted can join. And,
please
always do that.
State your names for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Patty Cullen, Vice President at Care Providers of Minnesota. And with me is John Houston, Vice President with Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance. We speak together in a cooperation known as the Long-Term Care Imperative. So we are here to testify in support of House File 775. This bill, what the Long-Term Care Imperative represents, nearly all of the nursing facilities in the state and many of the senior housing locations that receive elderly waiver funding, which also is benefited under this bill. On behalf of the hundreds of providers within our membership and their hundreds of employees who would benefit, we thank Chairman Bradley and many of the committee members who signed on as co-authors of this bill. Two quick points, and we'll be very brief today. First, you already know from Representative Bradley's comments that many of the human services providers receiving an increase under this bill have been experienced either 2 years of frozen rates or reductions under that and cannot continue to operate under this environment. Secondly, the greatest percentage of their budgets are connected to wages and benefits. So this bill does recognize those investments. At the same time, it does give some measure of flexibility for providers to cover their increased costs in some of the fixed expense categories, such as utilities, insurance, food, those kind of areas. We wanted to share with you a few facts that support the need for this bill based on a recent survey we conducted with our memberships. First, nursing facilities are subject to rate equalization, as most of you on this committee know, which means the state sets the rates for virtually all of the payers. And since the state froze rates for these facilities during the past few years, there was no ability for, at least in the nursing facility arena and many of the other programs, to raise the rates of the privately paying residents to make up the differences for these increased costs that we have experienced. During the same period of time where we have had frozen fixed rates, the costs for the expenses, as I mentioned, have increased. And here's a few examples for you. The average utility costs between 2003 and 2004 went up 3.8%, with increases ranging from 1.7% to 9.7% across the state. John?
Yeah. And a couple more examples. Representative Bradley mentioned liability insurance. We also have health insurance and workers' comp. The average increase for those per facility was $32,000 between 2003 and 2004. Workers' comp was was really a big one this year. We've had liability insurance costs go up in past years. This year, the average increase was 11.6% in workers' comp, and it ranged anywhere from 6 to 31%. Now, facilities have had to take some pretty difficult measures in order to deal with the freeze and these rising costs. The top three strategies that facilities used were reducing health care benefits, and Representative Bradley talked about the need to the heart and the mission-driven people, and that's why they stay. But when wages are frozen and your health care benefits drop, then it really becomes difficult. That was the top one. Freezing wages and reducing staff hours were the other two top strategies that were used. We do appreciate that the two-thirds of this bill is dedicated to compensation and wages. That does match pretty much what is the case for cost proportions within facilities. And this is going to go a long ways toward increasing staff morale and increasing staff retention, as Representative Bradley referred to. So we want to thank you very much, Representative Bradley, and committee members for and authors for recognizing the dire need for increases in House File 775, which will greatly benefit long-term care providers and their employees. Thank you.
John, do you want to give your name for the
tape? Yes, John Husted, Vice President of Public Affairs for the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance.
Are there any questions for two testifiers? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. The next one is Mike Chase or
Chase.
Close. Want to state your name for the tape?
Yes. My name is Michael Chase, and I've been the I've been a licensed nursing home administrator since 1974, so for 30 years. At the same facility, which is the New Brighton Care Center in New Brighton. New Brighton Care Center is a 64-bed skilled licensed Medicare, Medicaid, and I've also developed a 5-unit assisted living section called Senior Suites of New Brighton. I want to thank everybody for allowing me to come and speak, and I want to thank everybody for giving our problems some time and to address. I was asked by Representative Shar Samuelson to provide brief testimony in regards to a much-needed rate increase for Minnesota long-term care facilities. I think the previous speakers, Patty and I believe John, gave everybody a pretty good idea. I'm a working nursing home administrator. I'm in the trenches. I've been doing this for a long time. I believe I'm good at it. What has been the most difficult, in the 30 years that I've been a licensed administrator, probably the last 3 to 4 years have probably been the most difficult in my 30 years of practice. And what has been the most difficult is to try to maintain the type of quality that is expected by society, and most importantly, which is really deserved by the residents we take care of, in an environment of no rate increases. It'd be better not to be so dependent on the state of Minnesota. I'll be the first one to say that I wish we weren't in this position. But over 70% of my residents have some or all their care paid for by medical assistance. I'm a working person's nursing home. I'm not a Taj Mahal. We've taken a lot of the local New Brightonites as they've aged. A lot of times our facility is the facility of choice. It's a smaller facility, and I think a lot of my customers enjoy that, like that. But with 70% of the residents being having their care paid for by medical assistance and the private pay equalization law, about 93% of my income is 100% controlled. The remaining 77% is Medicare, which is also a cost-controlled system also. Our industry has been very tight for many years, and this problem has significantly increased since the rate freeze of July of 2002. There were also a few little cuts that took place at that time, the 10% markup for days 31 through 90, and a reduction in the bed hold. So besides not having a rate increase, and trust me, the reduction of the 4% that was in front of us was much scarier, so I was glad that we had a zero increase. But I'm here to tell you that I've been trying to make it work. Shar had came to the local nursing homes when she was first elected, knowing what the state of the Minnesota was in, and asked us how we could do more for less. I expressed to her then, as I do to you now, is that we've been doing that for very many years, participating in the medical assistance program. I stayed in this program through all these years, and I intend to stay in this program because that's where the majority of my customers are at. The cost that they alluded to, and I'll just briefly hit on them, because they were pretty well the costs that we've had the biggest troubles with. Workers' compensation costs, general liability costs, employee health insurance costs, utility costs, food costs, and technology upgrade costs. Our business has kind of been in the dark ages for a long time regarding computerization. Over the last 5, 6, 7 years, we've been moving more towards that, and we're going to need to move more towards that in the future. We need resident monitoring systems, fall prevention equipment, and other related technology are other issues that really seldom ever get talked about. But they are dollars that all of us are spending, whether it's to stay current with the reimbursement, the way we get paid, or health insurance or health department issues. We've had to move into the computerization. But in addition to all these things, my employees have not had a wage increase since July of 2002. And it's been tough. There's a lot of things that all of us have done through this time frame to try to keep costs down to a minimum. We can't turn down the heat. We can't cut down the food. We can't lower the quality of what we do. And that's really what's happening. The homes that have closed in the past may have closed for a number of reasons, but this is really getting to everybody. I don't know how much longer I can continue to maintain. I'm going to try hard. I enjoy what I do. I get a lot of gratification. My last survey, I am not perfect, but my last survey was deficiency-free. It's every year it's a scare. Can we continue to do well? Can we continue to cover our issues? Can we continue to give good care? But failing to provide a rate increase this year would be a failure by our society to recognize the important jobs that all of us do, from my nursing assistants to the laundry people. And you need good, honest, hardworking staff to do that job. I've used no pools in the 30 years that I've been an administrator. I believe in quality, having good people, and I like to keep them around. But it's tough. It's tough when, both in our case, we've had to make some slight reductions in our health insurance benefits, no wage increases. The job does not get easier. The health department is not easier on us. The expectations haven't lowered. And I'm just here to tell you that it's really getting to the point of almost an impossible task. And I'd like to continue to stay in this business. I'd like to continue to be able to get good services. But being as dependent on the state of Minnesota, we really, the COLA is a very important aspect for us to continue to do business. I can take any questions. Otherwise, yep. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chais, it seemed to me a couple of years ago you talked to us, and your nursing home had a remarkably low turnover rate of employees, which was a credit to you. Has that gone up some, or has the downturn in the economy compensated for that?
I think the people are starting to look, luckily with the economy being not as good as it has been over the last couple of years, and a lot of the nursing homes, most of the nursing homes being in the same shape, the employees didn't have all that many options, but that's starting to change, and I'm seeing more people looking for more money, and I'm trying to keep them around. I'm the cheerleader. I had dark hair, and it was quite a bit longer when I started in this business, and I didn't wear glasses. But I'm aging in place. I have my father-in-law in the nursing home that I'm at taking care of right now. I've had both of my other parents in one of our other facilities. So I've been a nursing home owner also, 25% owner of North Cities Healthcare, for everybody's information. I'm a second generation. I have a third generation coming up in the line, my son Ryan. I believe in what I'm doing, and I know how to do a good job, but we need the resources to be able to keep it up. So,
thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Chais? Seeing none, thank you. Next, do we have Doug Butler? Could you state your name for the tape?
Yes, good morning. My name is Doug Butler. I'm the director of Hiawatha Homes in Rochester. Hiawatha is a nonprofit private corporation, and we serve people with developmental disabilities, many of whom are medically fragile. A $10 an hour fixed wage is not sufficient to raise a family, pay for health insurance, and meet the rising cost of milk, gasoline, and housing costs. Many of our staff have large credit card debt. Hiawatha Homes, like other providers of community support to people with developmental disabilities, have had frozen payment rates for the past several years, except for last year when we had a 1% rate reduction. Discretionary income is not an option for most of the people who work in this field. Most hold two or more jobs to make ends meet. Many share rent expenses, housing expenses with others. The wage increase proposed and the annual inflation adjustment described in this bill will be most helpful. Bill, House File 774 will help us retain good, caring employees and thereby maintain quality of support due to clients that we serve. During the past years, I've had employees tearfully request hardship withdrawals from their meager savings invested in 401k plans just to pay medical bills and to repair vehicles so that they can get to work. Saving for retirement is only a dream and has little basis in reality for many of the direct support staff in our program. Within our workforce, we've begun to experience a reduction in group health participation because employees are increasingly unable to afford their share of the premium cost. This bill offers hope to underpaid employees and stability and support for people with developmental disabilities. So we look forward to your support of this bill.
Any questions for Mr. Butler? Seeing none, thank you. Next is Lynn Nornan. Again, state your name for the tape.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lynn Nornan, and I am here today representing the Minnesota Habilitation Coalition and the Minnesota Developmental Achievement Center Association, which are both provider organizations that represent day training and habilitation programs throughout Minnesota. I am also the Chief Operating Officer at RISE Incorporated, a community rehabilitation program and provider of DT&H services in Anoka, Chisago, and Hennepin counties. DT&H programs provide a variety of supports and services to adults with developmental disabilities to ensure their health and safety and to enable them to pursue their personal goals. Our services are aimed at achieving community integration and developing life skills and include support in finding and maintaining employment, retirement programs, leisure, recreation, and transportation, as well as behavioral supports and psychological supports for the people that we serve. Over 11,000 Minnesotans are served by DT&H programs each year. Most of those people receive some type of community employment. Indeed, in 2003, DT&H clients earned over $36 million for themselves, working at over 5,000 businesses throughout Minnesota. In a recent survey of our members, MHC identified that the demand for DT&H services grows steadily each year. At the same time, the cost of providing those services, as you've heard, has steadily increased, with insurance costs increasing, liability increasing, costs in terms of our utility costs and gasoline. And the largest part of our budget, as many of the other providers who've spoken to you today, is staff wages. And so the average wage in DT&H in Minnesota for a direct service worker is $9.68 an hour. And in order to increase that and have a significant statement to our employees about their importance, we need to be able to continue to receive increases in our rates. House File 775 provides a much-needed increase to these rates. In the last budget cycle, DT&H rates were cut by 1%. This year, the governor recommended no increase for our services in his budget proposal. A 3% increase over the next 2 years, as included in this House File 775, would put us in a much better position to provide the services that people need and want. We recognize that this is a very tough budget year, and we very much appreciate Representative Bradley's support and leadership on this important issue. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Nornan? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming to testify, and it is... And I think you're going to find a lot of agreement about the importance of this. Has your organization taken any position on new revenues for the state, new taxes?
No, our organization has not done that.
Thank you. Representative Abler.
Just a question, and welcome, Ms. Nornan. Could you comment just really briefly about just the ongoing challenges you have attracting quality staff and retention issues? I know you it's part of the whole theme, but just specifically in your niche, could you comment about that?
Sure. The services that my organization provides are primarily in the metro area, where the competition for staff is really strong. We have a very difficult time keeping people at the direct service level because of the wage level that we're paying. Most of our staff work full-time, say, in our organization, but also need to work part-time jobs in the evening in order to, you know, maintain any kind of quality of life. And as many of the other people who've testified today have said, a lot of people we're seeing are not opting to participate in a health care plan because they can't afford the premiums, even though in our organization we pick up 65% of the cost of that for them. They're still not able to purchase that coverage or participate in any type of retirement program. So it's very difficult, challenging right now to staff.
Thank you. Any other questions? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony, but I will say that it always amazes me that we have all kinds of health care providers out there providing health care to others, and they can't afford their own health insurance. Next, we have Jeff Bangsberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Bangsberg. I'm with the Minnesota Home Care Association. I also have here Kathy Barr from Healthy's Home Care, and I'm going to keep my points very brief so Kathy can say just a few items as well. On behalf of the Minnesota Home Care Association, I want to express our support for Representative Bradley's bill, House File 775, which would provide a 3% reimbursement increase for all long-term care providers in the next biennium. This bill includes a rate increase for home health care services, arguably the most cost-effective services in the long-term care spectrum. This proposed rate increase is desperately needed in order to recruit and retain direct care staff for the frail elderly, the disabled. Most individuals who receive home health care are on public programs and depend on paid caregivers to come to their home to meet the most basic care needs. Assistance with eating, dressing, toileting, bathing are necessary for those people to stay out of more expensive care settings. Access to home care is at risk due to low reimbursement of these services. If a rate increase is not approved by the legislature this year, providers in the home and community-based care industry and their respective employees will not have seen an increase for over 4 years. Providers cannot continue to operate at a loss due to inadequate reimbursement. A recent survey conducted by the Minnesota Home Care Association found that an increasing number of home care providers have stopped or plan to stop serving medical assistance clients who are contracted with counties to provide waivered services. If home care is no longer available, clients will need to be cared for in nursing homes at a significantly greater cost to Minnesota. And I'd like to hand the rest of my time to Kathy Barr.
Could you state your name again, please?
I'm sorry?
Would you state your name?
Sure. Kathy Barr with Healthy's Home Care. And good morning. Thank you very much for allowing me to present to you today. Again, my name is Kathy Barr, and I'm the Senior Director of Healthy's Home Care in St. Paul, Minnesota. We're one of the larger home health agencies here in the East Metro area, and actually have just recently celebrated our 20th year anniversary of doing business in the Twin City area. Our clients are mostly frail, elderly clients who are 70 years or older. And just like your parents, your grandparents, or maybe an elderly neighbor that you might have on the corner of your street, our clients want to stay in their home for as long as possible. Home health care is the most cost-effective way to provide the necessary care for them and also care for your loved ones so that they can stay in their home. Let me tell you a little bit about a story of one of our clients. Mildred is a 78-year-old female who lives alone in her own home on the east side of St. Paul. She's worked all her life to be independent and take care of her family. Now she has heart disease, diabetes, and has difficulty getting around during the day due to shortness of breath and arthritis. The nurse visits her every week just to check on Mildred's blood pressure, her pulse, breathing because of the shortness of breath, and also she has swelling in her legs that frequently break into open wounds. We need to check those. In addition to the nurse, we have a home health aide that goes out several times a week, and just as Jeff said, the home health aide provides personal care, bathing, shopping, grooming, and we believe that this warm and caring person provides an additional dimension to that lady's life. With the support of these services, clearly Mildred has remained out of the hospital for well over a year. If she didn't have the services, she would have been hospitalized at a cost much greater than home care, and she probably would have gone to a nursing home. But with the services, we can keep her at home in a safe environment. And that's where she wants to be. Someday, Mildred says, she may have to go to a nursing home. But at 78, her dream is to stay in her home that she's been in over 30 years for as long as possible. I'm sure when I'm 78, that'll be my dream, too. With the use of home care services, we can support an independent lifestyle. Today, each of us is planning for our future. And although we think we have an adequate plan, when our health care issues come up, we do find that we need the help of health care professionals to stay at home. The average monthly cost of home care under the Medical Assistance Waiver Program, which could be alternative care that I've heard referenced today, is about $1,300 per patient per month. On the other hand, the average monthly cost of a nursing home stay on a monthly basis is $4,100. Clearly, there's times when you have to be in a nursing home, but that's not always the case. Home care is a cost-effective way to care for people in our state, and for those clients that can stay at home with services, we should support their goals and their dreams. The 3% that you're proposing today is clearly a step in the right direction, and we thank you for your support of home care. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any sense from your client or the groups, the other groups, home health care groups, of how many would, if this 3% doesn't go through, of how many are going to close their doors and what the reductions are going to be?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think, in speaking to that question, we have lost a number of home health care agencies already in the last few years because the profit margin in the past, prior to the last 2 years, has only been a couple of percentage points. And I know a number of agencies in the metro area have closed. I couldn't give you a number offhand. But I do know that many, many agencies are having a very difficult time meeting the expenses that are fixed in an agency that was mentioned by Patty Cullen. We have expenses in home health care just like they do. And if we don't see a rate increase, we are really going to be very hard-pressed to see any kind of type of rate increases. Some agencies do provide a rate increase, like Kathy Barr's agency, but it's very difficult to provide any type of an increase when you're on such low rates with medical assistance. And sometimes there's a cost shift with some of her private pay to be able to allow that to happen. But other agencies cannot provide any type of rate increase at all for direct care staff. And it's not only the agencies that go under, but we can't find the staff because they're finding other jobs that will pay higher, like at McDonald's.
Mr. Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And did you say that at McDonald's?
Yeah.
Mr. Banks.
Sorry. Okay. Thank you. Have you tracked at all where the ones that have closed, where those clients have gone? Have any of your...
The Department of Human Services would probably be able to give you a better idea of where some of those clients have gone. There was a study that was done a couple of years ago when there was some major cutbacks, and a number of them did go into nursing homes. A number of them did try to find other agencies that were available to provide the care. It does disrupt an individual's life when an agency does have to shut down, and it can be quite difficult for them to deal with those different types of changes and those types of adjustments.
I think that one of the most significant risks we have when you have closing or access issues is the use of other type of health care resources, and that's going to be emergency rooms or some type of a more costly setting. And I think we really need to take that into account when we're looking for some really good ideas on how we can effectively manage health care. Emergency room placement, the use of the 24-hour observation for a client in an emergency room setting is not a cost-effective alternative. The example I gave you here today is a very cost-effective alternative to keeping those clients at home and utilizing the minimal amount of resources that you can.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with you 100% on that. I think that is the way we need to go. The last question is the question I had for the last testifier as well. Have the organizations you work any position on where we find the revenues to do this, whether it's through new taxes or cut, what other cuts we could find?
Not at this time. We just haven't taken that equation up.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I use this opportunity to make a couple of comments. One, I have been spending a lot of energy, and I hope that every one of us jumps in this, because we could talk about alternative revenues, but I think the reality is we've had presented to us is that you can't sustain by any tax plan an 18-19% increase per biennium. That we've got to somehow slow down the rate of expenses that are going on. I mean, that's a doubling of income tax about every 8 years, and I don't think any of us would really support that. So I do think there's going to be some sort of framework. I mean, the governor's framework in terms of bringing it down to 15% is probably about as good as you can do. I don't even know if we can sustain 15%. And let me just sort of plant a seed of an idea, because I think there's a seed of an idea that's just been presented to us. If this committee could figure out how we move the people who are currently in nursing homes, for whom we are spending the kind of expense that was just talked about, and have the capacity in home health or other kinds of places, that's a significant savings, and I believe the consumer is better served. Now, it's not that easy, but that's the kind of creativity I think that this committee is going to be needing to do, where we can have sort of win-win. It's not all going to be that, well, even that one's not easy. But it's an opportunity, I think we just sort of heard the testifier give us here, that is perhaps a challenge to this committee to figure out how we make that work for us. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for testifying. The next person on the list is Bruce Nelson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Bruce Nelson from ARM, and we're an association of 150 providers who provide services in ICFMR, the CADI waiver, the TBI waiver, the CAC waiver, the MRRC waiver, and SILS, and probably in a couple other of the areas that are represented in this bill. Those 150 members of ARM employ 25,000 of the most remarkable people I've ever met. I haven't met each and every one of them. The people that Representative Bradley referred to, in our industry we call them direct support professionals, and they're the people 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, provide the direct support to people with disabilities ranging from their meds to toileting to feeding, to all the way up to helping folks balance their checkbooks. There's a wide variety of people with various disabilities. I want to again thank Representative Bradley and the House of Representatives for your fierce advocacy on behalf of people with disabilities, the providers who provide their supports, and those 25,000 direct support professionals, and reiterate my gratitude for 2003. We didn't like getting a 1% cut, but we knew that in that context, we walked out of the session that year victorious relative to the pretty, in the context of the pretty tough decisions you all had to make. Since then, a lot of costs have gone up. We've heard about health care costs, liability insurance, gas at the pump. All these costs going up combined with that cut have had an impact. They've had an impact on the 25,000 direct support professionals. And in very real terms, when you put it in aggregate, their overall compensation has gone down. The 1% cut, but health insurance. Increasingly, our members have had to turn to their employees to maintain a level of benefit that they get in their health plans. The employees have had to pay more, or their health benefits have gone down. So in real terms, they've lost their $9 to $10 an hour in compensation. And in very real terms, the number of hours that they're working has diminished. You just don't have the money to employ as many people, so you have to lay people off or cut back on their hours. It's had an impact on people with disabilities and their quality of life. With fewer staff, stretched further, that means they get out into the community less. That means they get to do the things that they want to do, their dreams in life, less. There just aren't the supports to do that. Their ability, therefore, to be full citizens of Minnesota has diminished. It's had an impact on direct support professionals and their ability to stay in the field. They're looking, as Mr. Bangsbird said, at other jobs. McDonald's, sadly, is one of the options where maybe they can get more money. And we're seeing an increase, again, of turnover. As the economy gets better, people are turning over faster and faster, which puts more pressure on the really, truly remarkable, they're all remarkable, but the truly remarkable people who are there through thick and thin, no matter what, the core staff, they're burning out. And ultimately, their ability to support their own families. Now, there's a provision in the bill that calls for two-thirds of the rate increase to go directly to compensation for direct support professionals. I want to assure you that across the board, the members of ARM are going to exceed that two-thirds. We recognize that the very core of services, 75% of all expenditure, of whatever rate increase you get, or 75% of all of our expenditure is direct support staff. And therefore, recognizing that the very heart of quality care and quality support for people with disabilities is the around the direct support professionals, I assure you that every possible dime will go into their paychecks or into their benefits and will far exceed that two-thirds threshold that is in the bill. I did want to point out, Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, something we just caught, and as the bill moves forward, if we could take a look at it, there are enactment dates of when the rate increase would go into effect for nursing homes and the whole long list of waivers and so forth on July 1st, and ICFMR have January 1st. This is a real problem if this goes forward in our industry, as many of our members have both ICFMR and a number of waiver programs, and you have staff sometimes who bounce back and forth between two, or to give one staff person an increase in July and then somebody else in January. That's difficult to do and difficult to explain. So as the bill moves forward, I hope we can talk about that. I know it would add a little bit of cost to the bill. Finally, I just want to reiterate our gratitude that you're hearing the bill today, you're offering it, Representative Bradley, and we're willing to work with you all the way through, and therefore, on behalf of all those direct support professionals, thank you for hearing their cause.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you again. And next we have Shirley Hokanson.
My name is Shirley Hokanson, and I'm appearing before the committee today on behalf of RIM Minnesota. RIM offers a wide array of services for people with disabilities, including residential services provided by ICFMRs and the waivers. Through its services, RIM strives to empower people with disabilities to live, work, and participate in community life. RIM wishes to offer a thank you to Chairman Bradley for his leadership in offering legislation in the past and now that provided and will provide a cost of living increase for services for people with disabilities. RIM strongly supports the bill, House File 775. RIM recognizes the hard work and major responsibilities assumed by direct care workers. These unsung heroes bring commitment and caring to their work, and they do so for modest pay and benefits. RIM considers these dedicated workers to be the foundation of the service system and believes they deserve regular, systematic recognition and compensation for their work. Statewide, RIM has several thousand employees and values the work of each and every one of them. In addition to the need for decent wages for employees, RIM has, as has been indicated already, experienced ever-escalating costs in several areas. Among these are health care premiums, which have increased 16% over the last year. Looking at some of the costs, even the cost of gasoline has increased 10% in the last year. Finally, we thought it might be interesting to note that providers such as RIM strive to be good neighbors and become an integral part of the communities in which they provide services. ARM has compiled a list of wages paid to workers in each of the Senate and House legislative districts. As a complement to this, we have prepared an economic impact statement for each member of this committee who has a REM program in his or her district. For example, Representative Bradley, in your district, REM pays annual wages of $663,000, pays property taxes of $10,931, purchases food, and most of this is done locally, purchases food in the amount of $687,000, buys gasoline in the amount of $8,337, household items amounting to over $14,000, and utilities over $37,000. 10 of the committee members have REM services in their districts. 4 do not. However, even the 4 who do not, I know there are REM facilities close to them, such as Representative Walker's, where REM Pillsbury is right across the way. I've got the statements for each of these. The only two missing are Representative Eakins and Representative Powell's, which we'll get in the next couple of days. If I could, just for a minute, I'd like to go off script. As some years ago, as some of you know, I was a member of this body. My replacement, after quite an interim, is now Representative Thiessen, ably representing me. But during that period of time and in the intervening years, I, as many of you, have reviewed much legislation in all facets. Health and Human Services is one of the most difficult areas in which to work because there is a need from practically every angle. I remember the decision-making clearly, and I remember some of the agony that goes with it. Nonetheless, I cannot think of a more worthy piece of legislation than 775, which takes into consideration the needs of those people who provide services for the most vulnerable in our society. Secondly, off script again, in the last year, both of my parents died, who were in the nursing home for the previous 5 years. I had the opportunity to be an integral part of their funding, their day-to-day life in the nursing home, numerous conversations with staff and administrators and so on. These people were truly professional individuals, the direct care workers and the others, professional individuals giving committed care year after year. These people deserve a decent wage. And providers deserve to have these ever-escalating costs addressed. In conclusion, REM again would like to thank, back on script, REM again would like to thank Representative Bradley very sincerely for his work on behalf of people with disabilities and the people who provide these services. REM also wishes to thank the many co-authors on House File 775 and to members of this committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Hulkinson? Seeing none, thank you again. Steve Larson?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Steve Larson, and I'm the Executive Director of the ARC of Minnesota, and I'm also here speaking on behalf of the Consortium of Citizens with Disabilities, which represents over 40 organizations. The ARC provides advocacy and support for persons with developmental disabilities and their families. And one perspective that I want to share today that hasn't been talked about directly are the people that also will benefit from this, and those are the individuals with disabilities. We've heard about the direct service staff, over 25,000 individuals there. But there's 14,500 persons receiving services through the MRRC waiver or the Developmental Disabilities Waiver. 2,000 to 3,000 of those are children, and this waiver greatly supports those children staying in their family home, avoiding institutionalization, and so those individuals will greatly benefit. There are 7,000 or more persons on the CADI waiver, and these are primarily individuals that either have physical disabilities or mental health diagnoses, and they're at risk of nursing home placement, and so by supporting this bill, we'll also be helping those individuals. There's several hundred persons with traumatic brain injury that are receiving waivered services that are, too, avoiding nursing home placement. And 200 individuals that are at risk of hospital placement on the CAC waiver will also benefit from House File 775. In addition to that, there's the several hundred thousand people that are receiving home care services. There's the individuals receiving semi-independent living services, about 1,500. All of these individuals will be directly impacted by successfully passing House File 775. We're greatly concerned, both the consortium and the ARC of Minnesota, about the wages that people get and the services that are being provided and the impact that our current freeze is having on impacting safety and the quality of services. And as we've heard here several times, it's having a great impact on attracting new employees to provide services and supports to individuals with disabilities, as well as retaining good staff. So we want to thank the committee for considering House File 775, and we'd like to do anything we can to help you pass this bill this year. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Are there any questions for Mr. Larson? Seeing none, thank you again. And next we have Jane Akramowitz. And she can correct that pronunciation. I've had Latin, German, and French, but I don't think I've ever had Ukrainian.
You did quite well, actually. it's not quite afternoon. Thank you for allowing us to speak today. My name, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is Jane Okramovich. I chair the board of the Alzheimer's Association Minnesota, North Dakota. I'm here with Jim Mawson of the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 653. This is an organization that represents nursing home workers. We're here on behalf of the Seniors and Workers for Quality. It's a coalition dedicated to the principle that quality care begins with quality staffing. As an Alzheimer's family member, I see firsthand the importance of having sufficient and consistent, well-trained staff to care for people with dementia and the other chronic illnesses. This is true both for the residential and the community services, so I'm most pleased to see that this covers both of those aspects. Goodwill alone will not suffice. This mission takes resources and a rate increase of 3% targeted to the workers is needed now. Therefore, I speak in support of House File 775. Jim?
Again, I'm Jim Bosson. Representing workers, I sit across the table with administrators at nursing homes, working to reach agreements so the caregivers can feed their own families. The last few years of budgets have taken us backwards. A rate increase targeted to hands-on workers is among the highest priorities for the Seniors and Workers Coalition this year. We're glad that House File 775 goes beyond the funding included in the governor's budget. Stabilizing rates in long-term care facilities and services is a needed step. Let's do this and continue working on having staffing levels that experienced nurses say are crucial to good care. We must also continue to work to plan the kind of long-term care system we need for the future. That's not an issue just for the medical assistance budget. If we don't attract workers to this field, there will be few people to hire to care for us, even if we can afford the cares we need. But that's for another day. Thank you for acting on an increase for long-term care services today, and we appreciate your support for this.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, thank you. That was all we have on our list. Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, Representative Bradley, do you want to...
Mr. Chair and members, let me bring your attention to the fiscal note and do just at least a brief discussion of that. if you notice, the fiscal note in year 06 is a total of about $38 million, and in 07 is about $90 million. The action that we took on the amendment would reduce that biennium expense by about $20 million. And it gets a little tricky because if you remember, if you kind of took the governor's budget as a start point, the governor did do that, but then added a 2%. So there's a kind of an interaction here that we'll have to sort of net out. But I think what it says is that, at least in rough terms anyway, that we're talking about for the next biennium about $100 million investment here. And we had some discussions already about at least my strategy, and I hope it can be collectively the strategy of this committee, because I do think this is a priority for investment. We expect also, at least I expect as the author, to try to figure out a way to marry. If you remember, the governor's budget has a component which is sort of a quality initiative at nursing homes. And I think it'll be up to this committee to sort of work out how we marry the governor's budget on nursing homes with the recommendations of this bill. Outside of that, I think the bill is relatively straightforward. I mean, it calls for an increase. You can see that in the next biennium, of course, as one would expect, that levels out, and it's around $100 million a year, so I don't mean to diminish the amount that is involved in this. I can't say how much we'll be able to achieve, but it's certainly my personal intent, and I would hope that it's the intent of this committee to do everything we can to come as close to this this recommendation of 3% in each of the 2 years of the biennium. With that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for questions, and we can proceed for the vote.
All right, members, are there any questions for Representative Bradley, or you want to discuss the bill? I've seen neither. Representative Bradley, do you want to renew your motion?
I'll renew my motion that House File 775, as amended, be considered for possible inclusion in the health finance budget.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. You look very good in that chair, at least for today.
Mr. Chair.
The Representative Abrams.
Point of inquiry, since you're the boss, you may ask the witness, but we just voted on a bill for possible inclusion. In the past, we haven't voted on bills for inclusion. Are we going to do that now? I mean, I don't mind. I'm just curious. Is it?
Well, you could ask Madam Chair up there in front.